Hi, everyone. Dan Cassidy here. Welcome back to the Talking Markets podcast series here on the UBS Market Moves podcast channel. Our conversation today will focus on navigating the geopolitical landscape, including updates on Venezuela, the U.S.-Iran war, China, and we'll also spend some time focusing on what looks compelling from an investment standpoint across the emerging markets. With that, joining me here today at our 1285 podcast studio in New York, I'm glad to welcome from our partners at Bramsell Investments, Senior Managing Director and Head of the firm's Emerging Markets Platform, Arif Joshi. Arif, great to be back at the table with you. Thank you for dropping by.
Dan, thank you very much. And the new space looks fantastic.
Great to be back here at the table with you. So as I mentioned, a lot of topics top of mind for many as it relates to geopolitics at the moment, though to begin, timely that you're joining us today because I understand, Arif, that you recently returned from a trip to Venezuela. So can you speak to us a bit about the nature of your visit, who you met with, and what did you take away from the experience?
Sure. So Venezuela, very interesting country, both geopolitically, strategically around the world. Just a level set here. So this is a country with the largest oil reserves on earth, 10th largest gas reserves on earth. In the mid-1980s, one of the richest countries in Latin America, investment-grade credit rating. And as an emerging market debt and currency specialist, we are apolitical, but most importantly, we judge policies. We judge policies in emerging market countries. We judge policies in the developed world. So Venezuela, under the leadership of Hugo Chavez, did reasonably well, oil production at 3 million barrels a day. The last time I was in Caracas was actually the day that he died in 2013, and we had to be evacuated out of the country. Now, fast forward to after he dies, Nicolas Maduro takes over. Oil production starts to fall. Repressive economic policies come into play. The United States puts sanctions on Venezuela, and by 2017, Venezuela defaults on their debt. Fast forward 9 years, you have about 20% of the population that fled the country, looking for other areas, largely Colombia and the United States, for more economic prosperity. And then on January 3rd of this year, one of the, if not the most successful military operation in United States history, we go in and out of a country. Within 2.5 hours, take their president and first lady, and all of that is done without any fatalities on the United States side. So shortly thereafter, I went down to Caracas, and as I said before, we meet with policymakers. So we met with Delcy Rodriguez, the president of Venezuela. We met with Laura Daigou, who's the charge of affairs for the United States down in Venezuela. The CEO of the largest oil company, which is a nationally owned PDVSA, and CEOs and CFOs of the largest companies and banks within Venezuela. And it was a shocking turnaround 13 years later. It is a country where oil production has started to increase from a low of 850,000 barrels per day to about 1.15 million barrels per day. Safety is significantly improved in Caracas. It used to be that you would never leave your hotel room in Caracas. And now all of a sudden, and I don't want to overplay it, but all of a sudden you have moms pushing baby strollers. You have people walking on the promenade in Caracas. And as one entrepreneur told me 3 years ago, when you heard the sound of a motorcycle behind you, you thought, oh no, I'm about to get held up. And now when you hear a motorcycle behind you, you realize, oh, my food delivery has arrived. And he's the CEO of the DoorDash of Caracas. So long story short, you have vastly improved policy. But what's much more interesting from a bondholder perspective is it is with the anchor of the United States behind the transition. So you have Delcy Rodriguez, the ambassador of the United States in Venezuela, and U.S. Treasury all pushing in the same direction and actually all working on policy together on a daily basis. And what will be an interesting experiment is, and I suspect it's going to be a successful one, very much in line with how the United States dealt with Iraq after the Gulf War, is that all of the oil exports from Venezuela, just like they were from Iraq after that war, they are all getting routed into an account at the New York Federal Reserve. Hmm. And from that account, money then gets remitted back to Caracas for general purposes. And what eventually happened with Iraq is that when those bonds were restructured, the interest on those bonds was paid out of that account in New York City. And so myself as a bondholder, that was extreme comfort for me because I wasn't really taking Iraqi risk. I was taking much more New York Fed risk. I suspect the same thing is going to happen in Venezuela. As Ronald Reagan always said, it's a trust but verify situation. So it's going to require a lot of meetings with the authorities down there. But it's one of the most attractive investments today in emerging markets and one that I think is in the very early stages of a recovery.
Did you get the sense that the country is open for business when it comes to U.S. energy presence?
Yeah, there were. So while I was down there, there were a lot of oil executives down there the same week and the same month that I was. One person commented to me that this reminds me of Midland, Texas during the shale revolution. Remember that in Venezuela, we talked about the reserves earlier. What's unique about Venezuela is they have thick sulfuric oil. And what that means in plain English is when the oil comes out of the ground, it's the consistency of toothpaste. So in order to get that toothpaste-like oil into the pipelines, you have to dilute it. Where do the dilutants come from? Well, they come from the United States, both Texas and Louisiana. So this is why over the last 45 years, there's been a symbiotic relationship between U.S. oil companies and Venezuela. It worked extraordinarily well in the 80s, less so over the last 15 years. But there is a tremendous amount of people on the ground from U.S. oil companies, capital that is starting to get committed down there. What we need to see next are the institutions improving in Venezuela, and we're starting to see that in a new hydrocarbon law, a new mining law, and what we're hearing just this week of new central bank governors in order to improve the transparency.
It's a fascinating story and one that we'll continue to monitor, though very interesting to have some boots on the ground perspective, Arif. And Venezuela, as notable of a story as that was and continues to be, has taken a back seat of sorts in recent weeks to the U.S.-Iran war, which remains quite fluid as we're recording here on Monday, April 27th. I believe President Trump is meeting with national security officials in the Situation Room. There's been some false starts, so to speak, with ceasefire agreements. Remains very fluid. How do you see this playing out near term, and what might be some longer term economic implications to other countries in the region?
Yeah, those are great questions. So obviously we're in the fog of a war. So everything could change within a couple of days, either for the positive or the negative. I'll say this, that whenever we have these types of binary environments without a lot of transparency, we think about it from a game theory perspective. And you take it from the Iranian side. The big move by the United States, which really hurt the Iranians, was much more recently with the imposition of the blockade. And what the blockade does of the Strait of Hormuz is it restricts revenue to Iran on a daily basis. We're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars. And it also causes a situation where there's only so much storage that Iran has for oil that they produce. So the estimates are that sometime within the next 10 to 14 days, Iran is going to run out of storage. And at that point, it's very costly to start to stop production across a number of wells. And that causes some long-term damage. So we're on the clock, as they say. But from the United States side, we're also on the clock. It's a different clock. It's gas prices. It is midterms coming up. It is higher overall expenses, which goes into that whole affordability agenda. And the question is, how long can we go in the United States before things really start to go parabolic in terms of costs as opposed to a more linear move? And those estimates also happen to be a couple weeks, 2 to 4 weeks. And so from a game theory perspective, you're in an environment where if both sides are rational actors, you ought to see some type of resolution within the next couple of weeks. That is assuming President Trump is a rational actor. That assumes the Iranians are rational actors. And that's where we stand, that we think that's where we get. What makes this a little bit easier this time is that President Trump is willing to move the goalposts. In that case, that's a good thing here for the markets, because other what we would call red lines in the past don't necessarily have to be agreed to. A general context will get us there for the market. So that is our base case, that we get a good enough resolution that is defined as the Strait of Hormuz opening back up, a free flow of traffic through that. Listen, damage has already been done. Damage will continue to be done. We're looking at long-term oil futures in the mid-$70 range. If it goes on longer, maybe we're getting into the $80 range. These are not levels that cause recessions, but they are levels which cause some inflationary pressure, certainly pressure on the U.S. household. And those are all negative, but we're not – our base case is not that this sends us into a recession. Now, the second half of your question, which is almost more interesting, is what's the long-term consequence? And we view it really two ways. One is the world, and especially Asia, has realized that there is a choke point which could be severely damaging to countries around the world, their interests. And right now, they rely on the United States to cure that choke point. I suspect that most countries in Asia, some in Africa, if they have the resources, they will start stockpiling commodities. That's oil. That is industrials and metals. That is generally inflationary for commodity prices. It is good for commodity exporters. It's also inefficient. It increases long-term prices. It decouples countries from global trade. And then second is the learning that we had from the Ukraine-Russia war. In retrospect, ex post, what we realized is when the United States weaponized sanctions in 2022 against Russia, and we effectively seized Russia's foreign exchange reserves, the entire world central bank said, hold on, we've got dollar reserves. We need to start diversifying. That's what you saw. So many central banks around the world shifted to accumulating gold, and you've seen what has happened to gold prices over that time. I would suspect that many central banks around the world are looking at their dollar-denominated reserves again. I think many Asian countries are looking at the fact that they pay for oil in dollars. Iran is looking at the fact that they receive dollars mm-hmm. for their oil, and you will start to see a diversification of trading currency to fund those oil receipts, and that changes the petrodollar equation significantly.
You have to wonder how China is assessing these factors. We've covered Venezuela, Iran, and we have a key critical meeting coming up between President Trump and Xi. How do you feel that these events will perhaps shape those conversations coming up very soon?
Yeah, so one thing that we've been pleasantly surprised with is how well the Chinese authorities and the Americans are working together behind the scenes. You would have thought from Trump 1 that China would be our number one adversary. And frankly, they were during Trump 1. Now they've been in, along with Russia, more of a competitive partner, I would call it. And you've seen the tone shift significantly from Trump administration to towards China. And I suspect that whenever it is that we get that Chinese U.S. bilateral in Beijing, that it's much more friendly than many people otherwise would have thought. And that is, again, a recognition on both sides. China needs commodities and specifically oil to flow through the Persian Gulf. That is relying on the United States Navy to allow that to happen. We as Americans, we are relying also on China, and that's through the trade channel, and it's also through the funding of our very large fiscal deficit through the buying of treasury bonds from the Chinese authorities. So we're pleasantly surprised with how the China-U.S. relationship has evolved over the last couple of years.
And just one question on Russia. I did see headlines that perhaps Vladimir Putin may make his way to the G20 summit in Miami, Florida. Does that signal anything to you, should that come to pass, about the trajectory of the Russia-Ukraine conflict, perhaps an easing of tensions or a pathway to do so?
Yeah, I was surprised by that headline. It'll be fascinating to see pictures of Vladimir Putin on U.S. soil, potentially at the end of the year. I think the calculus is a little bit different from Russia in that they are in a much stronger position than Iran is. If you were trying to compare the conflicts, Russia can withstand for a very long period of time a war with Ukraine, especially with slightly less funding from the United States to Ukraine, especially with the need of armaments around the world instead of Ukraine. So our base case is that war continues for the foreseeable future. And Putin, everything else being equal, is in a slightly better position now than he was 6 to 9 months ago. Whatever final negotiation that is made there is completely and wholly reliant on Vladimir Putin deciding when to end the war as opposed to anyone else.
We've covered quite a lot of topics, just tying this all into investing with so much geopolitical uncertainty out there. Arif, how are you navigating this all as an investor, and what does look compelling to you at the moment across the emerging markets?
Yeah, so what's interesting in emerging markets is there are three ways that you can invest in emerging markets. You can buy emerging market stocks, which I think is what most people are familiar with. You can buy emerging market bonds denominated in U.S. dollars. That's the safest way to invest in fixed income. And then you can buy emerging market bonds denominated in the currency of that country. So there you're taking the bond risk and you're taking the currency risk. And what's interesting here is that emerging market dollar-denominated spreads, so lending to these countries in dollars, are currently in their 95th percentile of expensiveness over the last two decades. So there is very little value in lending to these countries in dollars. The margin of error is tiny. So we are flat-out bearish on dollar-denominated debt in emerging markets. Interestingly enough, those same countries in their local markets, it's the exact opposite. They're in the cheapest quartile that they've been over the last 15 years. Why is that the case? Well, after inflation hit the entire world in 2022, emerging market countries, unlike the Fed, hiked immediately. And they didn't hike by 25s and 50s. They hiked by hundreds. So you had a country like Brazil go from 2% overnight rates to 15% overnight rates. When you hike by thousands of basis points, as you would suspect, growth plummets, countries go into recessions, and that's what happened in emerging markets in 2023 and 2024. And emerging markets have been a very tough place to invest over a decade, from 2014 to 2024. It's our view that currencies bottomed in 2024, the dollar peaked in 2024, and we've just started a process around the emerging market countries where central banks are starting to cut rates. So from a bond perspective, if you can find countries that are in their initial stages of monetary easing, you want to be long rates in those countries. If you're in a world where investors are under-allocated to an asset class like emerging markets, you want to be long that part of the world. And then finally, if you're in a world where growth is starting to increase in some of these countries that are coming out of recessions, at the same time that U.S. growth is going from 2.9 to 2.7 to 2.4, and now we're tracking around 2.1 in the United States, what ends up happening is capital chases growth. And so we're expecting capital to leave the United States, chase growth in the emerging markets. I think we're probably in inning one or two of a long-term structural trend there. And the way that we're looking at that is really to focus on local rates and currencies in the emerging market world.
Arif, very generous with your time. Thank you for making the trip over to 1285 for the conversation. A lot of topics here that we can follow up on, so we'd love to have you back at some point soon. Thank you again for your time today.
Thank you very much. Great to see you again.
UBS Chief Investment Office's investment views are prepared and published by the Global Wealth Management Business of UBS AG or its affiliates. The views and opinions expressed in this material by external guest speakers are those of the author, speaker, and are not those of UBS, its subsidiaries, or affiliates. Accordingly, UBS does not accept any liability over the content of this material or any claims, losses, or damages arising from the use or reliance of all or any part thereof. This material has no regard to the specific investment objectives, financial situation, or particular needs of any specific recipient and is published for informational purposes only. For a full legal disclaimer applicable to the independent investment views produced by UBS, please visit our website at ubs.com/CIO-disclaimer.